Alrighty. My name is Hello everyone and welcome to Beacon Group's Noon Step Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Kim and I am an alcoholic. In an effort to lessen distractions to others and to respect our speakers, you will not be able to unmute yourself during the meeting. Let's start this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. AA Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and to help other alcoholics to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and everyone is welcome to attend, but we ask that only alcoholics participate. If you are new to AA or new to the Beacon Group, we strongly recommend home group membership and sponsorship. If you're new or not so new and looking for a sponsor, please put your name and number in the chat. If you have worked all 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and have a spiritual experience or awakening and are willing to sponsor, also please put your name and number in the chat. The chat will remain open during the meeting, except for while the speaker is sharing. Also in the chat, you will find our AA quote of the day. The quote source will always be from AA literature. Our speaker will share for 30 minutes on the step of the day, and of which will be timed. Then we split into breakout rooms for our small group discussions. Each group is a moderator who will divide the time equally and invite each person to share. Questions are encouraged during the sharing part of the meeting. When you share, please be sure your environment is quiet and free of distractions. Breakout room discussions end at 12:54. Followed by day counts, announcements, and the Lord's Prayer. And I have asked Sherry to read the 12 steps. And you can unmute yourself, Sherry. Or I can unmute you. There we go.
I'm Sherry Whitley, grateful alcoholic. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you so much, Sherry. Today we were here a talk on steps 8 and 9. Let's see, 8, we made a list of all the persons that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And step 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so will injure them to others. And let's give a warm welcome to Peter M. from Boca Raton, Florida.
Thank you. My name is Peter, recovered alcoholic, and grateful to be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Sherry, for the invitation. I'm actually playing hooky from work to be here and loving every minute of it. Anytime I can get out of the office for a little while. So thank you for having me. And My assignment is in 30 minutes to tell you about my experience with 8 and 9. I will tell you, I do have a sponsor. I do have a home group, and I sponsor a bunch of guys as well. And God gave me a sober date of June 23rd, 1988. Very grateful for this gift. You know, the longer I'm sober, we're talking about 8 and 9, what I've been sharing for a while now really fits into 8 and 9. And that is about relationships and cleaning up old scrapes and being with people close to me, transparent and even vulnerable, and letting them know where they are in my heart. And that's really difficult to do if I'm not living in what our book talks about, entering the world of the spirit and living there and growing and understanding the effectiveness. That would be an impossible task for a guy like me if I'm still walking around with the weight of the past all over me. How could I live now knowing how I lived then? And I'm crushed in this moment. I'm crushed today by the weight of the past. So my, you know, I learned a long time ago from one of my sponsors, Mark H, and he always would tell me that he and Gary and Don, this guy, Joe H, they were all, I mean, they get off the plane and you'd meet them at the airport and they wouldn't say hello. They'd say to me, "Where are you with the men's?" I mean, that was their greeting. And that the past will reveal itself in the present. So I had better resolve my past. Now, I knew nothing about this coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been through in the past 7 treatment centers, picking up a drink at 14 and not knowing where it was headed for. It was just an incredible euphoric time on my first quart of a cold 45 beer to take me quickly to institutions and getting locked up in treatment centers and landing in 1988 for too long, literally a bum on the street in lower Manhattan, a place called the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And back then, you had folks who could not afford to get out. They were stuck in the projects. But they were bombarded with knuckleheads like me. You had the junkies, the drunks, and then the crack scene hit. And so that was the neighborhood. And it was not safe. It was drug infested. And there I was. And for a while, I really thought I was okay and all that. If I was able to steal some money and go do what I needed to do, the world was wonderful. And when it ran out, I wanted to die again. And that was just a vicious cycle I was caught up in. And at this point, by 1988 in June, I had nothing but hate for myself, for God, and for anyone around me. It seemed to be the world was an obstacle and everyone in it was just a problem. I knew what I was. I just had no clue who I was. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I know what I am. I just don't know who I am. And it took a lot of unraveling of this knot, a lot of peeling away of the layers of the onion, a lot of depth of self, as we talk about often in AA, to find out who I am. I mean, I know I hurt people, but I didn't know the depths of the hurt. The thing, you know, I'm getting ahead of myself, but the thing with the men's, I was taught these things by wonderful sponsors, what we call external and internal. And I can, you know, have someone on my list that I stole $20 from. And it looks like, well, I'll just pay them back the 20 bucks and it's over. And that's an external thing. But internally, that person's going, "Oh, my God, you broke my heart when you stole money from me. It wasn't the money, but you were my friend or my brother or my sister or my son or my daughter. And I can't believe you did that to me. How do I repair that?" Because coming back with the money is easy in most cases. Having a conversation with somebody, albeit can be difficult and very humbling, but it's a lot easier to do that than to really take note and try to repair the real damage I've done and present to them, as Amends talks about, the change that has occurred in me. In 1988, I knew nothing about this. After 7 treatment centers, I knew I had to get to AA. After 7 treatment centers and the folks bring in AAs, bring in meetings in, I'd gone to a couple of meetings drunk. I knew you guys are out there. And for a long time, I thought AA was really just a cult. Everyone just was too happy. And there's no way that someone can go to work, raise a family, and not have anything in them. This, I was a little suspicious of that. And when these people would be so happy to be happy about God, I said, this is a little, they're drinking the Kool-Aid, and I don't know how far in I want to go here. 1988 changed a lot of that. When the big book says alcohol beat us into a state of reasonableness, alcohol beat me down to a point where I was negotiable. And quite frankly, it was desperation screamed louder than the ego. And part of my job in Alcoholics Anonymous is to continue to feed the soul and starve the ego. Because if I'm not careful, you know, you get a little rep in AA, you get a home group, you have service commitments, and you're sponsoring guys, and you know where the books are hidden, and you know where the shades are hidden. You're there early, and you're leaving late, and people are patting you on the back, and the ego loves all of this. And suddenly, I forget I'm an alcoholic. I'm just a cool member of my home group or AA, and because I speak, people judge me just on that, and a lot of folks can get up there and give an hour wonderful talk, and you see them in a parking lot, and it's a different person. So the ego likes all of that. And the ego wants to tell me, well, you don't need to complete those amends. You don't need to do that inventory. After all, look at you. You're gold. You're God. And the ego will reemerge. And Thiebaud talked about that. So for me, it was vital, as it is now, to have a sponsor, and at this point in my life, even some guys I can go to. Jimmy's out there, he's one of them, that we can just, you know, flush some stuff out and given spiritual consent where, you know, call me on my stuff. I can't see my own ears. You can. And so one of the things the steps do, especially with the men's, is I get freed of my own guilt. I get freed of my own remorse. I get freed of my own past, where I'm really able to be present. So many times I've spoken to men during a break in a workshop or after a talk. And, you know, many of them would come up to me and they have that look and they're struggling. And what has happened is they've gone on a spree. And most of the guys who've come up to me talked about they're on a sex spree and they're in a relationship or they're married. And they know if they get caught, they're in a lot of trouble, besides the shame that's brought about in doing that type of behavior. And then I ask them some questions like, do you have a sponsor? And when they go, well, that means they don't have one. And I ask them, where are they with 10 and 11? And it's non-existent. They're kind of just showing up for their sponsees. Then the big question, where are you with amends? And this was drilled into me from the get-go. Where are you with amends? And over and over and over again, I have found a lot of folks who have not completed the amends that they're consciously aware of, that in so doing won't cause more harm, are in trouble. Because the ego tells me I've entered the world of the spirit. The ego tells me it's okay. And the ego tells me I don't need to make that phone call, write that letter, go see that person. It's old news. And so I'm walking around with plaque on my soul trying to be present. And I'm still driven by old ideas, attitudes, and emotions which are leading me. And I'm in fear most of the time, because if one of those people did show up in a shopping mall or a restaurant or in an AA meeting, I'm going to be mortified because I owe and I haven't paid back. I haven't sat with that person hat in hand. The great thing about doing step 9, it crushes the ego every time I'm making an amends. So my 8th step came out of most of it came out of my 4th step list. I say most of it because people were put on there that weren't on my 4th step because I wasn't angry with them. I didn't have a resentment. But I was writing this 4th step list, this 8th step list after prayer. Because in reality, I'm not really writing the 8th step list. God is. The pen's in my hand. But there were people I thought about that I stole from, and some not very gentlemanlike behavior I had with women in my past. I wasn't angry with them. I was just a self-centered, self-seeking drunk, and it was all about me all the time, and I had to go back to them. And so the journey begins into the world of the spirit for me. It's interesting, back in step 3, they talk about any lengths. In step 8 and step 9, they mention any lengths in each step. reminding myself I was willing to go to any length for the spiritual experience, because it's really easy to put the AA car in neutral about now. We'll make a couple of amends, feel good about that, and I'll get to the rest when it's convenient for me. But it really isn't on my time. What the ninth step promises when we look at them, they look a lot like the opposite of page 52. In 52, it's about me and I'm under it. And step nine, the promises are really about getting out there and repairing and having these new relationships, starting with God. And so I began praying to this list when it was created. And I put everyone on there that I knew I harmed. And that included drug dealers and people that normally wouldn't want to be around. Everyone went on that list, including family members and things like that. Ex-girlfriends, school teachers, rehab people. I've been through seven. I was not a poster child for rehab. And they went on that list. And I was praying for the willingness to go to these people, every single one of them. I was not on that list because God took real good care of me by now. God was on that list. And I found the best way to make it right with God was taking care of his kids and practicing these principles in all my affairs. And what I found out years later, to complete this amends, if you will, and then begin to walk it out and live it, I had to become a member of my church community again, which I turned my back on. And I found I was living a life of a hypocrite, praising God in the rooms of AA, but never going to God's house. It's really funny. Like my church meets on Sunday and we have one service on a Saturday. And there's about a half a dozen I can select. And it's not even an hour. It's about 50 minutes. And it's about maybe 5 miles from my doorway. Now, if you ask me to take a speaking commitment upstate New York, and I say lived in Jersey, and it's about a 3-4 hour drive, and it's a group anniversary, and there's going to be 300 people there, I'm up at 4 o'clock in the morning with a call out, and I'm going, suiting up and showing up. But tell me to go for 50 minutes, about 5 miles from my door, just to go into God's house and say, thank you. Oh, you know, I'm really busy. I got things to do. I can't make it. I was the hypocrite. But sometimes I had to come to terms with my brokenness in order to get free. And so I started to pray to everyone on this list, and off I went. Now, I wanted to go to both of my brothers and my dad immediately. And a really good sponsor gave me really good suggestion. He didn't tell me, he didn't edit it for me. He didn't tell me yes or no, but he steered me. And he says, they need to see the sermon before you go talk about one. You need to walk the walk for a while. And in actuality, the walk is the talk. The walk is the sermon. And so that's what I did. And I work with my dad, and I was around both of my brothers quite often. And so my job was to get to work early and leave late, like they taught me in AA. And to be a team player, not cause any controversy, just be part of the team and go to work. And as my sponsor says, when I go to work, I work. And when I was with my brothers, I tried to be an older brother to them. They're younger than me. I tried to attend their house when they would have a dinner or something like this. And my brother would want to meet for lunch. I made sure I'd show up. That came first, even before home group, many, many times, so I can give back. And I did this for a while, and my sponsor says, keep praying, and God will tell you when to go see them. And they were the most emotionally challenging, if you will, for me, or difficult ones, because both of my brothers and my dad saw all or 90% of my nonsense. I've often said that God worked through my dad, and my dad kept me alive long enough to get to you. And so what does this look like live? I went to my middle brother, and I sat with him, and I was sober a little while, and I shared with him the wrongs I was clear on without dragging him through the mud. I have no right to save my own skin at someone else's expense, but he knew it. And I had some financial restitution I had to make. And I asked them, there's anything you need to tell me, and what can I do to make this right? And with a choked up voice, he let me have it about what I did to my dad and to the family. Because what happened to my family because of my alcoholism, both my brothers and my dad were arguing regularly on what to do about me. And my grandparents were involved, and my cousins, and the whole family was involved. I took everyone hostage, if you will. And my experience with Al-Anon talks about this, that one drunk in a family, everyone else loses their identity and their voice because it's centered around that drunk. And at the end of the conversation, it simmered down to this. My brother said to me, "I thought you were going to die, and I couldn't even think of that." Every time the phone rang, I says, "He's dead." And that's how they slept. That's how they ate. That's how they went through their life. And when I sat with my middle brother, who ironically is a big strapping guy, he fell apart crying. And he just kept saying, "I thought my brother was going to die." My youngest brother attached himself to my hip when he came out of mama. It's that type of relationship. And he's still that way in a lot of ways. But he was very emotional about how afraid he was. Now, I'll tell you, when I was in the throes of my addiction, both of my brothers just wanted to beat me up so bad because of what I was doing. And I remember sensing the hate that was coming out of them. And I couldn't see where that was coming from until I got sober. And then I understood. I had a lot of changing to do, a lot of fixing, a lot of repairing to do. And I'm happy to tell you, I cannot do that on my power. But God could and would if he was sought. He's the miracle maker. And then I had to sit with my dad, and that came much after. And I'll never forget this, and I've told this story from a million podiums. My dad would not let anyone raise his children or interfere with how he was going to raise his three boys. That means priest, rabbi, minister, treatment center, psychologist, policeman. No one was getting involved. That was made clear with everyone, including my grandparents. These are my sons, and I'll raise them the way I think I should. And I respect him for that. But through the amends, he pretty much turned me over to you to raise me. And I sat with my dad, and I was saving money. I owed him, if I hit the lottery for a few million, I probably would owe him a few more million. It was like that. And I saved about $500 in an envelope. And I was going to make a payment plan with him. And he had seen me walking the walk and showing up for work and talking about AA. And he knew something was going on. And I said, "Do you have a few minutes to talk to me?" And the way my dad was, yes. And he got real quiet, and we went off to the side and we sat down, and I began the approach. And the approach was recognizing the harms I caused and an attempt to repair this. What gave it credibility was I was walking the walk, thank you, God, and AA. And I got about, oh, Lord, a couple of sentences out. And my dad put up his hand and stopped me. And what he said to me, I'll never forget. He says, "All I ever wanted was my son back." He didn't want the money. He didn't care if I was a carpenter or a doctor. He just wanted his son okay. That's what it came down to. And what he began to do was, this tough guy from South Brooklyn, was praise you. And he said to me, "Whatever those people are telling you to do, keep doing." He turned me over to you. I got married about, let's see, April, May, June, July, about 16, 17 months ago, in the month of April, down here in Florida. And my dad was there, and he was starting to get ill. He just passed a couple of weeks ago, and he was starting to, the decline was really hitting, and he was in a walker. And he would go out early in the morning and sit in the little garden area and smoke and have a cup of coffee. And my wedding, we could have read the preamble at my wedding. There was all of us were there. And they would come out in ones and twos and threes and fours. And they knew he was my dad. And what AAs did was they'd go over to my dad, say good morning, shake his hand. The ladies would give him a little kiss on the cheek. And they all would sit with him, have a cup of coffee, talk a little bit, smoke a few cigarettes. And then another crew would come out. The night of my wedding, my dad said to me, I can't believe these people were alcoholics. They treated me with such incredible respect. Every one of them spoke to me, and he would say, they're impeccable. Again, he raved about you. The message we get to carry. And so I'm out making my deal. I'm talking about my first time around making amends. And what I learned was, even though I might have a 20 or 30 or 100 people on my first 8-step list, I'm not done, because I might continue to harm people, not purposely or intentionally. And God knows what's going to get revealed in the second time or third or fourth or 10th time I go through the work. God's going to give me only what I can handle most of the times. And there was one amends on my list. There were a couple of amends on my list. And one was a gentleman who worked in a treatment center and this ex-girlfriend. And I tried to reach out to this gentleman in a treatment center many times with no luck. And I was working for my old sponsor, Mark H., and doing some marketing work. And I went to my alma mater, and that was a treatment center, to do some marketing. And I arrived there like 2 hours early. At least 2 hours early. And I was really embarrassed to go in 2 hours early. I thought I'd look like a fool. And something had me go in. And I grabbed my duffel bag and I walked in reluctantly. And as I'm opening the door, who walks out as this guy? This amends took 17 years to find this guy. And when I introduced myself, he recognized me immediately. And I did some damage to him, almost got him fired. And I told him about you and what I belong to, how my life is. And he gave me the biggest hug. He says, you're good. I couldn't even finish the amends. And he wished me well, shook my hand, and I never seen him again. But that part of my work was done. I didn't get one referral from my alma mater, but that's why I went there, to that treatment center. And another was with an ex-girlfriend that took about, well, I just moved to Florida. So I would say I was sober, if my math is right, about 23-ish years. That's how long that one took. And it came through social media. I just got on social media. I didn't want to be any part of Facebook or that nonsense. And my boss basically put a gun to my head to go on. And within a week, I get this message. Are you Peter Marinelli from 70th Street? Oh, my God, I thought you were dead. Can we talk? And I was able to make amends to her and her family about the damage I did there. The amends is not my time. It's in God's time. But I need to be in the batter's box, willing to go and repair the damage done. Because when I get to do that, I get to enter the world of the spirit. I can't have a spiritual awakening as a result of steps 9.5. I need to complete my outstanding amends. And we talk about our promises, and I'm probably getting out of time here, but it says this: if we are painstaking for about this phase of our development, painstaking, thorough, with great care, really paying attention. My life depends upon this stuff. I'll be amazed before I'm halfway through. I'm going to know a new freedom and new happiness. And they use the word new. And for me, it's this new awakening, a new aha moment, a deeper relationship with God. I thought I was free, but now I really know what it's like to travel light, with no skeletons in the closet. When a book says we can go anywhere on this world free men can go, I can do that. I'm not afraid to walk into a meeting and say, uh-oh, I harmed her or I harmed him. I won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it because I'm using it. Now, when I'm talking to a drunk or to a family or what I do for a living, my past somehow becomes a great asset here. I'm not proud of it. I'm not ashamed of it anymore. I'll comprehend the word serenity. I understand serenity because I have it. It's not a theory or a word on the page. I'll know peace because I knew turmoil. No matter how far down the scale I've gone, I'll see how my experience can benefit others. 12-step work. When we give a talk of what it was like, I'm sharing what happened to me. It's this shared brokenness or this wounded person sharing, and everyone goes, yeah, I identify with that. I don't go talk about it on the street corner, but when it serves a purpose, it does really good. How can I reach a drunk by preaching at him? I usually reach a drunk by telling him a little bit about me and what I've done. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. This is the opposite of page 52. Self-seeking will slip away, and my whole attitude, my entire attitude, an outlook upon life will change. My point of view has shifted. God has closed the ears to the mind and opened up the ears to the soul. I'm looking out. My point of view is not looking out from my mess anymore. But I'm finally seeing on some days with God's eyes and hearing with God's ears. My thought life is not creating my reality anymore. And on most days we travel light. Now, that doesn't mean life doesn't happen. This has been a really, really, I'll put it mildly, challenging couple of weeks for me. When I travel on the weekends, and I do that a lot, come back from a conference Sunday and Monday at noon, for years, my dad would call me at noon, like clockwork. How was your conference? How was your flight? How was the weather? How's marriage? That kind of stuff. Noon Monday after a conference. And I've been on the road for the last 4 weeks and I haven't gotten a call. And this morning I was talking to my wife over coffee, and as she's talking to me, she says, I got to give my dad a call today. I can't. And so I'll be totally transparent here. I've been a little lethargic. My motivation is not with me. I've been disciplined in praying and meditating, but I feel like I'm stuck in mud. And I have this vision of, they put my dad in, I think it's called a mausoleum, when they slid the coffin in there and sealed it. I can't get rid of this vision, and it's breaking my heart. And so I'm just grateful that I didn't miss anything with him. There's no regrets that I should have told him, and I didn't make that amends. It was clean. And God will heal me the way God heals me. But I will tell you the importance of my sponsees calling me with the same old nonsense has been blood for me. It's been a heartbeat for me. And going to my AA meetings and getting on the road these past few weeks, I have a bunch of these Zooms, and I really cut back on a lot of Zooms. But I took a bunch, and I agreed to do a few more just to be of service, to get out of my own way. And the importance of when my friends call me just to shoot the breeze for a little while, it's air in my lungs right now. I've been praying like a son of a gun. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. That doesn't mean I'm going to hit the lottery and be rich. It's just that money doesn't own me. I like money. I wish I had more. God has kept me far away from having a lot of money. It's been 35 years. I'm waiting for the winning lottery. I didn't hit, by the way. I would have told you if I did. But he keeps me right-sized. And sometimes it eats my lunch. But I'm not walking around, oh my God, over finances. Because there's a bigger part of me that knows God will keep me above ground. God will keep me buoyant in the water. God will point me in the direction he needs. And I need to totally lean all the way into God. And I'll intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. How could I possibly get intuitiveness if I'm not current? Intuitiveness comes from being current. And if I'm still wearing yesterday or the past all over me, I'm never going to feel intuitiveness. I'm not even going to recognize that voice. But when there's no past and no future, I'm here with you and I can hear that voice. I am out of time. That was the buzzer. So I can go on for a couple more hours if you want. If you no, thank you so much for listening.